It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We examine real estate market conditions in parts of Wisconsin and how a slowdown in home buying affects the livelihood of real estate agents. You can call in with a question, share your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Sewell is a realtor and past president of the Realtors Association of Northeast Wisconsin. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Glad to be here.
Yes, and Paula Hall here as well, Executive Vice President of the Realtors Association of Northeast Wisconsin. Paula, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Paula, let's start with you. The National Association cites that last year the number of realtors hit record highs nationwide. St. Louis Fed saying national home prices are over $100,000 more than in 2019. So how do home prices affect the number of realtors?
We do see it kind of ebb and flow with how home sales are going with how many members that we have. If you go back to pre-COVID numbers, we were a little bit lower. We're probably, in our area, we were lower. Well, actually, in all of Wisconsin, nationally, we were lower. And then what you saw, which is very common for the realtor industry, real estate licensees industry, is that most people come from other industries when they become a realtor or a licensed real estate agent. So after COVID, you had people in the restaurant industries. Anyone that had those downsizes because mm-hmm. of COVID kind of looked into the real estate industry to see if it would work for them. And a lot of them came in, and it did work because we started to have the housing boom then that started in 2020. 2021 was the peak of it. And then in 2022, you started to see things slow down a bit because of lack of inventory.
Michael, what did you witness with the pandemic influence and the number of agents entering the profession?
Well, just like Paul said, we did have an increase in agents joining after the pandemic or during the pandemic. And as with the housing market slowing down with regard to inventory, lack of inventory, then, of course, we have people that are struggling a little bit because sales are down, the number of sales are down. So with more agents available in the market, it is a little bit of a struggle for agents right now.
What does it take to become a realtor?
It requires 72 hours of training, specific training, and then passing a test administered by the state in order to get a real estate license. Once you have a real estate license, then you can decide whether or not you would like to join the Realtor Association, which is a trade association. The National Association of Realtors is at the national level, then the Wisconsin Realtor Association is state, and then we also have local, the Realtor Association Northeast Wisconsin, in our case, in Appleton, Green Bay, and that general Northeast area. Being part of the Realtor Association is what you were talking about, membership. And that is people that are active in real estate as licensees. Most likely they're going to be joining the Realtor Association. And that's where you have the number of people that are, you said the numbers were up nationally.
Paula, just in recent days, our state assembly passed a bill that would allow people with licenses from other states to potentially operate in Wisconsin. Should realtors be allowed to practice across state lines?
As long as you are competent to practice in the state of Wisconsin, we have approved forms, which is very important, and not every state has that. So I think it really comes down to the competency. Do you know your market? Are you able to serve your clients and customers to the best of your abilities when you are outside of the area of where you are stationed?
Paula Hall with us, Michael Sewell, Paula, current executive vice president, and Michael, former president of the Realtors Association of Northeast Wisconsin, as we take a look at market conditions and hear what you're experiencing in your area. Call in with a question, share thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, St. Louis Fed says there are roughly half as many homes for sale now than in the middle of 2017. And you say low home availability makes it more important for sellers to work with their agents. So why is that?
Well, when we have low inventory, when we have low inventory, it means that we're going to have a lot of competition for each listing that's out there. I think it's very important for buyers to work with qualified professionals, people who are experienced, because they want to make sure that in a competitive market like that, you want to put your best foot forward. You want to put put together the best offer that you possibly can. Every buyer's circumstances are unique to that particular buyer. And a good real estate agent, a good realtor, will be able to assist them in putting together the best offer they can in a competitive market. And the old days, you would write an offer, you might get a counter offer, you might want to counter back. That's not going to happen in a market where you have so much competition. You want to make sure you get your best offer on the table right away so that you can be considered. From a seller standpoint, because you're likely to have more than one offer coming to you, you're going to need the professional help of an experienced realtor to filter through all of the offers that you have, whether it be two or three, or in some cases, eight or 10, to make sure that you can figure out which is the best offer for you.
Michael, what makes an offer stand out?
Well, a number of things is going to make it stand out, and it's not always price. In fact, one of the things that an inexperienced seller may look at is, gosh, this is the best price. This will probably be the best offer. Well, if it involves a loan, you're going to have to look and see how much down payment the buyer has. That could affect how strong an offer is. And the real estate agent may say, gosh, with coming in with a low amount of money down and a really high price, if this doesn't appraise properly, we may be renegotiating the price at a later date to keep the deal together. An inexperienced seller may not recognize that as an issue, but certainly an experienced realtor will be able to point out those kinds of things and help the seller make the best choice as to what's the best offer in terms of terms that are favorable to the seller. And every seller situation is unique as well. Sometimes price may be the most important thing. Sometimes the terms may be the most important. Other terms. So that's going to be a situation where both the buyer and the seller are going to want to have professional assistance.
Paula, you know, Redfin says Wisconsin has a 2-month supply of homes. What would a balanced inventory look like?
A balanced inventory is typically a 6-month inventory. Mm-hmm. In the Northeast area where we are at, we have about a 2.7 month inventory, which is up. So we are starting to see more new construction, more availability. The market is opening up a little bit. So I like to see those numbers climb up a little bit, but it is still definitely low at a 2.7 month inventory.
Paula Hall and Michael Sewell there with the Realtors Association of Northeast Wisconsin as we discuss market conditions for home buyers, how people in the industry handle the ups and downs. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts and experiences. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Wisconsin home prices trend upward and supply may not keep pace with growing demand, we hear the perspective of real estate insiders about navigating these market conditions and get your insights. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. We have Paula Hall with us, Executive Vice President of the Realtors Association of Northeast Wisconsin. And Michael Sewell is here, past president and an agent in the Green Bay and Fox Cities region. Let's bring in Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Good morning, Kate. So I flipped a property with a family member. At the time we were selling it, we just were doing for sale by owner. the buyer had an agent, and it worked out to their advantage because it definitely got my family member and I interested, because they offered us double the earnest money. They came in with the mortgage pre-approval for a loan beyond what we were asking, and then they also offered us $2,000 past what the price we were asking, just so we'd hold it, so we wouldn't lose it.
Marcus, thank you for sharing that story. And Michael, that sets us up with a number of questions. One being, do you see flips going on in Wisconsin?
Well, what Marcus said is consistent with what I talked about before, about having a buyer having a real estate agent that's trying to make sure that they can put together the best offer for their particular buyer. And that particular case, it sounds like they put together a variety of issues that were beyond just what the price was, although it sounds like the price was a good price as well. And I think that that's going to be something that you're going to see, not just with for sale by owners, but with listed properties as well. And it's consistent with what I said before about working with an experienced agent to help put together each individual buyer, putting together their best offer. Sounds like it worked out well for Marcus and his family, though.
Do you have any insights on homes being renovated and then sold very quickly? What are your thoughts there?
Well, the term is the handy term is called flipping a home, buying it, rehabbing it, and putting it back on the market. And as long as I think one of the things that is important for buyers is to get a home inspection when they're purchasing a home. I think that's an important aspect. And certainly as long as there's a home inspection so that the home inspector can take a look and make sure that the rehab has been done appropriately and properly, then I don't see any issue with that particular. I think we're trying to find new inventory in a variety of ways. New construction, of course, is going to be important, but rehabbing existing homes is an important aspect in increasing our inventory as well.
Paula Hall, how do you increase inventory? What do you see as the big things that Wisconsin can do to add to the number of homes that are available and that are affordable to Wisconsinites?
That is a great question, and that has been the fight of what we've been looking at for the past few years. We have legislatively passed some things that will help us out with that, like the Main Street Residential Housing Rehabilitation Loan Program, that's giving decent loan specifics to rehab those downtown areas, right, that have, it could have been commercial or business space, but now it could be moving into a residential space and kind of opening up that. There's a lot of opportunity out there. It's just that we need to see if we can change the way that we think, possibly building more duplexes, more multifamily homes and spaces. We need to just create more options and think a little outside of the box in order to increase that inventory.
Change the way we think. Is the way we think that a single family home is only the preferred way?
I think that's probably the first way that we think about it, which there's nothing wrong with that. But in order to really get some inventory out there, we need to think of all of the options, not just a few.
Michael, we see that the average interest rate on a 30-year mortgage is roughly 6.6%. That's down from a November high of nearly 8%. How much should people weigh current interest rates when buying?
Well, it depends on a lot of different factors. Interest rates, obviously, are very important to first-time home buyers and many, many home buyers. I think what we're going to see, one of the things that's going to help our inventory over the next several years is this concept of what they're talking about, the silver tsunami, which is people over the age of 50, the boomer generation, is starting to put their properties back on the market. Now, that's 20 or 30 million between 20 and 30 million homes. And it's not all going to hit at once. In fact, I like to think of it more as a glacier type move than a tsunami, which comes all at once. But I think we're going to see an increase in homes over the next 10 to 15 years. That it's going to be a natural increase that way. Now, those individuals probably don't have to worry about interest rates because they have enough equity in their homes to, when they're downsizing, to purchase for cash. So that's not going to be affected by interest rates. But I think interest rates are going to continue to remain low. I would not be surprised to see them throughout 2024 to be in the low sixes, maybe even dip into the high fives. And I think that that's going to stabilize over 2024. And then I think that'll be beneficial to home buyers and home sellers alike.
Let's take a call at 800-642-1234. Jerry in Neillsville. Jerry, hi. Hi, Jerry. Can you hear us? Oh, I think we've lost Jerry, who has a question about a loan. Their daughter selling their house and wondering about an offer they received from a realtor. Jerry, maybe we can try to get you back in just a moment. But Paula, you know, for someone who maybe is a first-time buyer, how do you compete with all cash offers?
That might be a better question posed to Michael, who's more in the field. I would not technically work with the buyers.
Michael, what are your thoughts on all cash offers and how to put in, you know, competitive offers when you don't have everything up front?
Well, an all cash offer is certainly looks good when you come in that way and say, I've got all cash in this situation. Sometimes having all cash, though, may not be quite what it looks like, which is, again, why you want professional help through this situation. We've seen situations where all cash is coming from, you know, Uncle Ed, and Uncle Ed at the last minute decides maybe his money should be used somewhere else, and those deals can fall apart. So we want to make sure that we're getting adequate proof of funds and things like that with an all cash offer. But basically, at the closing table, every transaction is cash for the seller. The money comes in; it may be coming in partially from the buyer and partially from the bank, but it is cash. So as long as you're coming in with a strong loan program with a good down payment and pre-approvals, like Marcus talked about earlier with his buyer, then there shouldn't be a problem with competing against an all cash offer, because as I said, at the table, ultimately the seller gets all cash regardless.
What is keeping home values climbing in Wisconsin?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Inventory.
Oh, okay. Paula, go ahead. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're just seeing home prices keep going up and up. What is causing that?
I would say that would primarily is the lack of inventory.
Okay.
When you have less on that market, you know, those prices are going to increase. And until that starts to have a larger inventory, we will see prices start to stabilize.
Paula, what expectations should buyers have when hiring a realtor? What should they be looking for?
I just moved to the east side of the state. I was located in central Wisconsin, and I moved last March. And I hired a realtor to sell my house, and I hired a realtor to be my buyer's agent in the Northeast industry. And it was very important to me because of their knowledge of, and I've been in this industry for over 20 years. I'm very knowledgeable of how things work. But working with an active agent, an active realtor in the field that has so much knowledge of all of the different industries that touch a home sale, you've got title, you've got lending. And of course, then you've got working with buyers and sellers was completely important to me. And I couldn't imagine doing it without it. I'm sure I would have had a terrible deal working on my own.
Okay. So in terms of commissions, Michael, what drives the price of commission for realtors?
Well, commissions are always negotiable with regard to depending on what the services are. Not every real estate company is the same, and certainly not every agent is the same. So based on the services that are provided and based on the services that the seller is looking for, the commission can be negotiated with the agent and with the firm that you're working with. So you're not going to see a consistent commission from company to company because different companies are going to offer different levels of services. What a seller needs to look at is what services are important to them, what does that agent provide for them, and then working that through the commission at that point.
We only have about 10 seconds left. Paula, what is the easiest way to improve curb appeal in the dead of winter?
probably keep up your outside shovel.
Right. Well, Paula and Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for having us, Kate.
Michael Sewell, realtor and past president of the Realtors Association of Northeast Wisconsin. Paula Hall, executive vice president of the Realtors Association of Northeast Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's Recovery Voucher Program provides a new round of grants for organizations that cover rent costs for people to live in recovery residences. We check in on a grant program that targets residents who are experiencing homelessness and struggle with opioid use disorder. Call in with a question. Share your comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dawana Bremer is director of Salvation Army Grace Place in New Richmond, offering services and shelter to low-income individuals and families in western Wisconsin. Dawana, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for inviting me this morning.
Yes, and Cheryl Dietrich is here as well, president and CEO of NewCap, a community action agency providing services for low-income people and families in Northeast Wisconsin. Cheryl, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much. Good morning, Dawana. Hope you're well today.
I am. Is everybody staying warm?
Indeed. Well, Cheryl, let's start with you. This is your organization's second time receiving the grant. What is the structure of the recovery housing services for people who receive the grant at NewCap?
Well, the structure is folks who are seeking these services contact us. We have them initially work with one of our crisis mitigation coaches to have them go through an initial process to make sure that they are presumptively eligible, that they meet the definition of homelessness, that they are seeking recovery help, and that there may be a bed available for them in a site in our area. Actually anywhere in the state that we can connect them with. Then they work with one of our content specialists who helps them do all that heavy lift of the paperwork that we have to do to guarantee that they're enrolled correctly and that everything is done properly. And then they enter a recovery residence. We pay for their care while they are there, for the cost of them to be there, and support them while they are on that part of their journey.
So through the grant, organizations received $125,000, and the requirements for how the funding can be used has changed. How is NewCap using the funds from Wisconsin's Recovery Voucher Program?
One of the things that we're doing differently this year is that, first of all, last year we only were able to help individuals who were moving into recovery. Now we can help families as well. As we all know, when someone that we love in our family is going through a difficult time, then the entire family struggles. And when you're talking about substance use disorders and homelessness, then that is especially true. So we're able to help families, which we are very excited about, and we're using a whole family approach to do that. Then we can also pay for coaching, and our coaching model is part of our whole family approach, but the coaching really starts when they leave recovery. We work with a family, if there is one, while the individual is a resident of the recovery center, and then when they move out of recovery, then we work the family and the person who is recovering from the substance use disorder anywhere from 1 to 3 years, depending on how long that particular individual or household would like to continue with coaching. We help each individual, if the family, with goal plans, and then really help them along their journey. We transitioned from a case model and supervisor mentality about 2 years ago. We believe that it's their life, that they're adults with agency, and that our job is that we help them along the journey. We ride with them. We hold them accountable to their goals, and then they hold us accountable to what we promised to help them with and to be there for them and with them. This is a really, really difficult journey, and we know folks need a lot of support.
It's interesting you know calling it crisis mitigation coaches and really coaching people through a really difficult period in life. And I would imagine the coaches also try to ensure that people don't have major setbacks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is the most difficult thing that anyone will ever do. I mean, if you think about, so we're here in January where many of us have resolutions, and most of them, you know, are around our health. And we also know that most people fail in those within, you know, 3 or 4 weeks of setting the resolution, just because it is so difficult to do. Mm-hmm. Changing your life is really difficult. And in this particular instance, we have a chemical substance that has altered the chemistry of the brain. So people are trying to find new ways to deal with the struggles they're having and new coping mechanisms while they're trying to fight the way their brain has been rewired. It is very, very difficult, especially for this particular population of folks we're talking about, because if you are homeless, especially if you have a family, but if it's just, even if it's just you, if you don't know where you're going to sleep tonight, or tomorrow night, and the night after that, and if you don't know if you're going to be safe, and then if you add your children to that or your partner, you don't know if they're going to be safe, because one of the first things that happens when people become homeless is they usually become victimized. It happens very, very quickly. And I often say to community members and to community leaders who say, well, people just need to stop doing the drugs or doing whatever, and then their lives would be better. Well, first of all, way easier than said than done. And second of all, if I was homeless, if I had children, I would certainly be reaching for something to help me dull that pain, whether it was alcohol or something else. So I can understand how it happens. In fact, I'm a little shocked that it isn't 100% of folks who are homeless aren't dealing with some sort of substance use disorder. We're talking about losing the most basic thing that humans need, which is shelter, especially in northern Wisconsin.
Juana, your organization operates an emergency shelter for the unhoused. How is your organization using its funding?
Yeah, our program is a little bit different. We are receiving referrals from treatment centers, from caseworkers, and the referrals come into our office, and our navigator connects with that particular individual. And there's a couple options. Our first priority is to get them into safe shelter. So if there is not any space available in any of the sober living facilities in our area, they will come into Grace Place until an opening occurs at one of the sober living facilities. During that time period, we will work with the individual to make sure that they are receiving any of their basic services, possibly food share. They may need help with getting some identification. And when you think about homelessness, first off, homelessness is a challenge in itself, coupled with an addiction issue. And I guess I look at our society, and I don't think that there is probably one individual that addiction has not affected you in some way. Either with a neighbor, with a family member, with someone in your church community. So it really affects all of us. So without even dealing with the sobriety issues, it is extremely challenging just to be homeless. I always think about this. You had one bag with your belongings. How do you keep all your important papers? That's virtually impossible. If sober living facilities are available, individuals will go right into a sober living facility. And again, we can help them with assistance for 2 to 3 years. The good news is, like Cheryl said, we can help families this year. One interesting thing that we have done is we are working with another group in our community that provides mentoring. And this is a mentor that is someone who is in sobriety that can work with the individual or the family and walk with them. One, they have firsthand experienced addiction issues, so they will be able to relate to that individual in a better way, some ways, than people that have not walked that same path. But again, our main goal is to get them into safe shelter immediately and then move them into a sober living facility as soon as possible. We are also working with the individual when, let's say, their stay is completed at a sober living facility, then where do they go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they're providing case management to help them secure housing, to secure a safe and stable place so they can continue on their path for recovery.
Duana Bremer, you know, at Salvation Army Grace Place, and you're in the northwest part of the state, Cheryl Dietrich leading NewCap in the northeast part of the state, so kind of opposite places. But Duana, do you find, when you said placement, if available, do you find that there are vacancies for what the people who come to you need?
In most cases, I have to say, we can get the individual directly into a sober living facility. It's really, I mean, we are very, very fortunate. There are five sober living facilities located geographically in our area. We utilize all of them.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases, we can get them in pretty quickly. If there is a delay, then it's usually a week or less.
Okay.
So I have to say that's one area that we are very fortunate in our community that we have that accessibility.
Cheryl, when you're serving families, do you find that placement is more difficult?
Finding housing for anybody in our areas, and I'm sure in the Northwest as well, is very difficult. Affordable housing is an incredible need everywhere. It was before we've seen the really high raises in costs for housing. It's even more so now. So it is getting more, it is difficult. In our area, we serve three housing coalitions in the region that NewCap serves, and our unsheltered homelessness numbers have gone, frankly, through the roof. In fact, in November of 2020, in response to that, NewCap started doing emergency housing as well. We do an interim housing model for emergency shelter, but we serve only families, and we can serve six families at our site in Green Bay and six at our site in Shawano, and we are seeing more need than we can possibly serve in those. Like Duana, we have six sites in our area that are recovering housing that we can get people into. We originally wrote to serve 34 individuals last year. We served 59. Mm-hmm. We were really surprised, not that the number of folks who needed the assistance, but that there were enough spaces available that we could find for them and that were available. I think there's always going to be more need than we have capacity for. I've been very happy to see with these funds that we're using money that was set aside from the recovery from the opioid
settlement
funds. Legal funds, mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. That they're actually going to what they were set for, that the cause was opioid and other drug disorders, and we're covering them, the recovery part, with this fund, where I'm very excited to see that we're really doing that. I got to take my hat off to people who designed this program and set funds aside. But I think that I think the gap in our area is we still need more housing that's available. We serve 10 counties, about 500,000, 600,000 humans altogether, just in our 10 counties. Half of them are here in Brown County. There are not enough sites here. But again, we can put people anywhere that there are sites available. As we're just seeing, especially that the word is getting out that this is available, then people are coming to us with more need as well. And our individuals, we don't have nearly enough beds for them, especially not for people who have disorder issues.
Cheryl Dietrich, President and CEO of NewCap, Duana Bremer with us, Director of Salvation Army Grace Place in New Richmond, as we discuss recovery residences for people experiencing homelessness and who have a diagnosed opioid use disorder. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new round of grant funding to seven Wisconsin agencies helps to provide stable housing in what are called recovery residences for people who are experiencing homelessness and struggle with an opioid use disorder. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your insights at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Cheryl Dietrich with us, CEO of NewCap, and Dwana Bremer, who is director of the Salvation Army Grace Place in New Richmond. Let's bring in Kevin in Madison. Kevin, hi. Go ahead.
Hi. I think my question is just peripherally related, but there have been a couple of cases where I've been down near downtown in Madison in the evening, like after dark, and I've come across somebody who's, you know, lost or stranded. In one case, it was an elderly woman with a walker. In another case, it was a younger man and who spoke very little English, and I didn't speak his language. And they just seem to need help. They don't have anywhere to go, apparently. And I never knew who to call or where to send them. In one case, I called the police, and that just seemed to be the wrong thing. They assumed I was calling because the person was causing trouble, and I don't think she was capable of causing trouble. She just needed help. And
Kevin, thank you. And I want Dwana to respond. Dwana, go ahead first.
Yeah, I'm thinking one of the best places in Madison, I think, to call would be the Salvation Army. They do operate, I believe, two shelters in the Madison area. Our shelter is located in northern Wisconsin, St. Croix County. So I'm not as familiar as I should be with shelters that are in Madison. But the Salvation Army would be a good place to start, and that would also provide you with a referral.
Cheryl, what can people do to help the situation?
Well, I think noticing it is one of the first things what the caller said was really important. Noticing. So often we tend to look away from things that we don't know what to do with. So just noticing and trying to intercede is I think the first step. I know Madison has a very strong homeless and housing coalition in the Madison area. 211, especially in the more urban parts of the state, you know, Milwaukee, Madison, maybe Eau Claire, I know in the Green Bay area, it's pretty strong. So that's also a really good option that folks could call if they don't know a specific site to make a call to. And 211 can often do those on the spot referrals too.
Cheryl, NewCap, as you have talked with us, develops affordable housing and recovery housing. There is coaching in the process. How does your organization approach relapse and maintenance medication for people with substance use disorder, like Suboxone, for instance?
We also have six health clinics, and we have behavioral counselors on site. So we approach this we try and surround people in what they need. So we do have those services available. As far as relapse, I think the reality is the vast majority of people are going to relapse, and they're going to need additional support. And I think more than anything, in addition to the medication supports and all of those recovery supports, we also use a peer specialist model that Dwana mentioned that they use out in her area. And having somebody walk with you who's been through it, who knows this isn't I'm going to get this 10 pounds off and keep it off for the rest of my life. I'm going to stop smoking today and never start again. I'm going to recover from opioid disorder and never be tempted or never fall back. I think in most cases that tends to be fantasy, not reality. I think most of us can empathize with that just from our own lifestyle change struggles. So we stand with people. We know that they're going to struggle. Especially our peer support specialists, they have been there. So they don't make it okay for them to relapse. they make them know that they're not failures and that this is a journey, and it's a difficult one. There's nothing flat or, you know, straight about recovery. So I think that's the most important thing that the peer specialists bring to individuals and families. And I think they can also provide hope for families, saying to them and showing them, I was there, I went through it, my family went through it, and I'm here now. And I am still in recovery, but I'm here, and your loved one will be too. You're going to get through this, and we're not going to let you go. You're not going through it alone. You have support. So that's the most important thing that we do about relapse. So we do have medications available. We have the behavioral counselors, which I think are helpful, especially for that long-term process. Mm-hmm. And then we can help with Medicaid billing and Medicare billing and private insurance. We can cover all that. So we do have those things available.
Juana, the Recovery Voucher Program is in its second round of providing funding to Wisconsin organizations, and that funding expiring at the end of the year. Is this program successful enough for the funding to continue, do you think?
Oh, I think absolutely it is. We are in a very rural area, and last year we did provide assistance to 44 individuals, which, kind of like what Cheryl said, that was sort of shocking that we were able to help that many folks. One of the reasons, too, that I actually wrote for the funding is we were seeing a lot of people that came into our homeless shelter, and they were at a point where they were like, okay, I'm ready to leave, but I have nowhere to go that's safe. So we were thinking that with the recovery voucher, that would give them additional time to stay in sober living, to work on their recovery, because relapse is part of addiction, unfortunately. And it's not that people want to relapse. It's just sometimes things happen. I do have to make a comment, too, for us, if they're needing any additional medication, we do not even offer that in St. Croix County. Individuals have to drive all the way to Eau Claire. Wow. So that makes things a little bit more challenging and a little bit more of a hardship in a real rural area, because we don't have a lot of the services that some of the larger metropolitan areas have.
Cheryl, we only have about 10 seconds left. In terms of this program and these funds, do you see it as successful enough to keep this funding to continue?
Absolutely. I think the numbers that of people that are being served and the successes that we're seeing, even though we're only at the very beginning of year two, I think they're impressive. I think they meet the goals that were set out for the program. I think they meet the goals that were set out for this entire settlement of the opioid funding. I think that it should be done. And like Dawn, I think the most difficult places to do this program are in rural Wisconsin. The urban Wisconsin has its challenges because not enough sites. So,
but thank you both so much for joining us there. Cheryl Dietrich, CEO of NewCap, Dawna Bremer, Director of Salvation Army Grace Place. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. She's known as the trans handyman on TikTok, and she has a big heart for renters because she is one. We welcome back Wisconsin's own Mercury Stardust and tackle things that need fixing, drains that need unclogging, and other helpful tips to make a home comfortable. Call in with a question. You can share comments along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mercury Stardust is a professional home maintenance technician, performer, and activist. Her book is called Safe and Sound, A Renter-Friendly Guide to Home Repair. Mercury, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, hi. How's it going this morning?
It's going well. So glad you're here. And, you know, you think renters are overlooked in home maintenance. So why do you think renters get short shrift?
I think it's because we have this notion that if it isn't a property, we don't really have a say with it. And I think that that conversation right out of the gate is a very one that's filled with inequities. You know, I think that it's hard sometimes for people to understand why someone would want, you know, to have a say in their home, you know? And I think that the reason why we wrote the book was basically to start this conversation and to try to open up the gates a little bit when it comes to this information in our own homes.
Yeah, renters are often people who are viewed as lesser, you say, just because they're renters. They don't own that property. They don't own that land. And that has a ripple effect.
Yeah, and a lot of renters are also people who are in the LGBTQIA community or are in other marginalized communities. We have to look at renters not just as people who don't have a house, but often are people with other marginalized identities that might be affected when we're talking about the economic disparities in the country.
So you have what you call a checkity checklist. This checklist you should get from your landlord to document the state of your home when you move in. Why emphasize this documentation?
The more that we document everything from emails with our landlords and technicians, and the more that we document like what's already wrong when we move in, the more we're protected when we're moving out. Mm-hmm. So if we know, hey, you know, that base trim when in the kitchen is damaged, that we're not going to get charged for that when we're moving out of a rental. And those kind of things are super, super important when we're talking about just protecting our finances.
Mm-hmm. And you also recommend negotiating the lease through email. So a lot of digital documentation going on here.
Yeah, take photos of everything. Everything that you could document and put into like, you know, put into the cloud or put into Google Drives is all good. You know, we're in this wonderful time of almost too much information in the world. So I think it's good to just kind of like contribute to that and have that in your back pocket, because we don't always remember what's wrong. And in the rule of court, we need to have evidence in order to support what our claims are.
How common is it for landlords to not return a renter's security deposit?
I think, you know, when it comes to how actually common, if I looked on data, I think the data would probably suggest that it leans on a side of more for the landlord and a little bit less for the tenant. But it's really hard to say that, you know, for sure without having a lot of data. And data is different for everyone across the whole country. Mm-hmm. I will say that the majority of renters feel like we don't get our deposits back. And the debate over what constitutes as not getting the deposit back and why is just one that's sometimes really hard to quantify. And we don't see a lot of renters take landlords to court because, I mean, it's really expensive to do so. And sometimes we're only arguing about like $400 or $500. And for a renter, that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. For a landlord, that's a drop in the hat. So that could be really difficult for us to be able to get support from the court system.
And it's really, you know, in terms of damages, it's such, you know, the eye of the beholder. I mean, what is considered normal wear and tear and what is considered actual damage? It can be different for every eye.
It can also be different for how long you've lived there for. You know, like every passing year, we are dealing with more different kinds of normal wear and tear. If you've been there for 7 to 8 years, well, most carpets in, you know, in rentals don't last that well. You know, this is on the cheaper side sometimes. Sometimes you do run into some really nice carpet, but most of the time it's carpet that's going to wear out between 7 to 8 years. And if you've lived here for 10 years and your carpet is still immaculate, then why is it when you call for a new appliance, they push back against you? You know, like I think that we have such, you know, this tenuous situation between I need to make sure to protect myself financially because, you know, this isn't an investment for me. And then you see the other side where this is actually my shelter. This is how I stay warm in the winter. This is how I stay dry in the summer. And those two things feel very incompatible sometimes when we're having these disagreements and arguments.
Mercury Stardust, our guide to home maintenance, and has a new book out called Safe and Sound. You can join in the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Mercury, when you're deciding on a potential place to rent, you know, you mentioned about, of course, documentation, but you also like to know how long a typical tenant stays in the apartment. Why is that relevant?
That's a really good point. So when people are moving into a new place, knowing how long the previous tenant was there for is a great indication of like what's going on. I lived in about 8 different rental places in a course of about 10 years. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that, like, I couldn't get settled. It wasn't because I didn't want to stay there. It was because, oh, maybe it was too small, it didn't fit my needs, or I got pushback from the landlords, or felt uncomfortable with communication, or didn't feel safe with the landlord, didn't feel safe with the technicians. You know, there's so many lists of things. Finding a home, especially in the rental market, can be really hard when it comes to location, where your job is, to where your home is. So all of those factors go into how I am debating about living at a place. And one of the major ones is if that person who lived there prior to me lived there for like 2, 3, or 4 years, that might be an indication that it was at least a good enough a place to sign multiple years of leases for. The days where we could sign a 3-year lease are gone. Hmm. We live in an era right now where signing 1-year lease is kind of the standard almost everywhere across the country. And when we find a place where it's a monthly list, that's even more rare these days. So being able to know that the person signed multiple 1-year leases is a really good indication that this might be a place that you can at least settle in for the next couple of years.
Well, let's take a call now. Ethan is joining us from Whitewater. Ethan, hi, what's on your mind?
Hey, I was just curious. I know there's a lot of different information out there, but most leases that I've ever signed, the landlord will include something about carpet cleaning that must be done by a professional company. And like you said, you know, you can keep the carpet as clean as it can possibly be, but they'll still charge you for that. And then I've, in some cases, just seen them come in with a Stanley steamer or something that they told me I could not do.
Yeah, there is. So when people are moving out, especially, there is this notion within the industry in which I was in for 17 years that we want to make sure that we have evidence that things were done properly, right? And when we are paying someone for their service, instead of just relying on people to do the work themselves, that is more to protect us in a legal sense than it is to protect us in almost anywhere else. And, you know, we get a lot of pushback on this kind of stuff. Like people within the industry, when I mention this, get upset that that's how I view it. But I was in the industry for 17 years and I know the communication we had behind closed doors. And it was very much about like making sure we have a paper trail, because as people who own the property, we can protect ourselves by making sure that we have a long, strong a paper trail. And if someone complains, oh, hey, the carpet doesn't look clean, we can be like, oh, actually, we did this about 3 to 5 weeks ago, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a way to just basically look good, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, carpet within the industry is such a standard to replace it after someone moves out that it's often kind of a chuckle when people live in a place for 3 to 4 years and them not replacing the carpets. These carpets don't hold up very well. They're very thin. They're usually corrugated carpet, which means that they pull apart at the seams. And it's not uncommon to go into a place and see several runs that are indications that this carpet may need to replace anyways.
Mercury Stardust is a professional home maintenance technician in Wisconsin. The guidebook to common repairs, it's called Safe and Sound. And you can join the conversation with a question. You can share your thoughts at any point. Call in at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here in the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken, professional home maintenance technician in Wisconsin. Mercury Stardust is a lifelong renter, has a guidebook that is focused on renters and how to proactively fix dozens of home maintenance issues, along with tips on how to effectively communicate with a landlord. Be part of this discussion as Mercury troubleshoots. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mercury, you know, you've got these freshly painted walls as you move in. They're, you know, begging for something to be there to make it, you know, something that feels like home. And you write about using painter's tape as a way to help hang something on a wall. Can you explain this technique?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you got like a painting or you have something that has two holes in the back of it, if you put painter's tape on the back of it, and you mark off where the holes line up, and then take that painter's tape and put it in a level, and then mark it off on the wall using a level, mm-hmm. then boom, you got it. You know exactly where the holes are. You know exactly that it's level. And this can take less than a minute and a half to 2 minutes. It's so much faster than what I was taught when I was younger, and that was just to guess and pray.
And it's those little things, because when you walk by, it's straight and it's not, you know, hanging in an odd way that catches your eye. I mean, you want those little things to be just right.
Yeah.
Let's go to
details.
Details matter. So Let's go to Lanny in Ashland. Lanny, hi.
Well, hello. How are you guys?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I don't know. I'm a 72-year-old man, and I've owned a lot of property. I've owned a lot of rental property, and now I'm renting again, you know, in Ashland because I got rid of my big house. But I'd like to tell the viewers or the listeners that, you know, make sure you watch your P's and Q's when you live in a rental place. I mean, you know, if the carpet, maybe take some pictures before you move in, you know, how the place was, because at the end, you know, when you're moving out, you know, your mind's really not right there. You've got something else on concern. But I think, you know, proof is in the pudding. And the more notes you take and the more pictures you take, whatever, the more proof you have, you got something to stand on. That's basically all I got to say.
Oh, Lanny, know, thank you for that. Mercury, I think you'd probably say amen there.
Absolutely. Documentation is so important. And I think it's another important topic to talk about is a lot of people, when we are aging, find ourselves back in rental properties for the first time in sometimes many years. I did a 54-city book tour last year, and I met so many people. But the amount of people who I met that were seniors was a wild amount, not what I thought I would see from my demographic of listeners and followers. But there are a lot of people who are elderly who are now, in the first time in sometimes 40 to 50 years, are renters again. And it can be really a culture shock, especially when you're calling the shots for a long time and all of a sudden you're not. And I think that's another important topic to have when we're discussing these type of things.
Jerry in Verona called in and says that they believed Illinois might have had a renters union and people could call in, tell about their situation, and the union would negotiate on their behalf. And Jerry says it's a good idea to have that representation on both sides. What are your thoughts there?
In an ideal world, every single apartment complex and every single rental property would have a renters union. And these are starting to become more and more popular. They can start by just one person in a complex saying, hey, if we all work together, we can make sure that our voices are heard. It is very difficult in the reality to get these started and to actually have them last. But I'm a huge advocate for it. I really do think there's a lot of landlords get very skittish around this idea, but I really do think it's beneficial for all of us to have open communication and all of us to have our voices heard, and also to understand that you may own the property, but these are people's homes, and they should have a say with what happens in their own community. Often landlords or technicians don't even live in the communities in which they're providing services for. And I think that could be a huge factor when we're talking about this. We need to better our communities, and we do that by giving each other voices.
Mercury Stardust with us, new guidebook out, professional home maintenance technician and focused on renters. You can call in with questions, 800-642-1234. Chris in Eau Claire is here. Chris, hi.
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. I was wondering, for that question about negotiating rental terms, would you know if there's a difference between family-run versus a corporate, I guess, rental provider, and if there are certain things you can or can't do in either case?
Such a good question. First and foremost, when we're talking about family-run property management companies, usually this means somewhere that's under, like, 10 properties. It can really range. Sometimes it's just one person in their basement, you know? But when you're dealing with that, you're going to be able to have a lot more leeway. It becomes way, way more individualized when we're talking about smaller property companies. When we're talking about corporate properties, it is a huge legal battle, right? They're dealing with hundreds, sometimes thousands of properties, and that means that they're going to have a lot less leeway. They might not be as willing to cut the corners on something, because if they're doing it for one, it may open it up for hundreds, and that imbalance can be difficult to work with. So it's always good to ask the question, and it's always good to get it all in writing, but just know you may not hear what you want going in. And in the state of Wisconsin especially, we don't have a whole lot of leeway. It is more like a seller's market than it is a buyer's market in a lot of ways, right? Mm. It's harder for us to find properties right now in Wisconsin that fit our needs as renters than the other way around.
Thinking about how the management company might not even be in Wisconsin, and if there is an emergency, like let's say your apartment, your home is broken into, what should your landlord and you do? What should be, you know, how do you address a scary emergency?
Oh, the first thing I will say is that we should always have renter's insurance. I think that that is a huge part of it. When it comes to someone breaking into your apartment especially, one of the first things that we're going to ask from a property management standpoint is, you know, did the person have the key? Do you have all the keys? And we still might change the lock and all that anyways. And then we need to change the lock if we get a police report. So legally, I don't think I was allowed to do a lot of stuff unless there was a police report. So remember that even though sometimes we might not want to get the police involved for so many reasons, that legally we kind of have to have a paper trail in order to make sure we can get some jobs done. But when it comes to like our actual safety themselves, I talk to people about Google Homes, you know, having some type of security system set up with cameras is always good. I like to err on the side of caution. Be aware that in some leases, it does indicate that you're not allowed to put up cameras facing the entrance or the exits of your apartment unless you get permission from the property management company. So be aware that there are some tricky language when it comes to this stuff. But I believe that if you're a landlord, we should allow people to be able to protect themselves with the means that they have. And if they're not able to put a large permanent lock on the door, at the very least, let us use temporary devices to protect ourselves.
Mercury Stardust is a professional home maintenance technician in Wisconsin, author of a new guidebook on common fixes around the house. And you can join the discussion along the way. Call in with the question, add your home repair tips at any point. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We discuss handy home repairs with Mercury Stardust, known as Trans Handy Ma'am on TikTok and a professional home maintenance technician in Wisconsin. New guidebook is focused on renter-friendly repairs. And we heard from Carol in Lake Geneva, former apartment manager, who says number one way to get your security deposit back, just clean the place, Carol says, including your oven. You can be part of the discussion on DIY fixes. Call in with the question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Let's go to another Carol. This is Carol in Milwaukee. Hi, go ahead.
Good morning. I would like to talk about Milwaukee's situation. There are not enough building inspectors. My building inspector told me, after he got through helping me for 3 months, it took him to get the, or a total of 4 months before I got the squirrels out of my house, because my landlord didn't want to do it, get rid of them, it seemed like, because he could have gotten rid of the squirrels within 1 month. But anyway, I think he could have. But anyway, the building inspector told me, he was very nice and everything, but he said, we can't waste time on small issues like yours. Don't call again if you want to help the city, because the city has to take all these new kind, I think they're the new landlords who don't really live here, which is most of the rentals. We have to take them to court. They will not do anything when we give them reprimands. They wait to be taken to court. So I guess these building inspectors do not have time for all the problems in the city. That's my opinion.
Carol, thank you for bringing that to the table. Wasting time on small issues, but squirrels doesn't seem to me, Mercury Stardust, like a small issue.
See, what Carol was bringing up is actually a larger issue, and that's out-of-state landlords and the battles and the legal issues that we're having across the country. We've never seen it quite this way before. You know, we've always had out-of-state landlords at a pretty high rate across the country. It has increased quite a bit in the last couple of years. And it's made it really, really difficult for local legislations to be able to enforce the laws that they have. And so what you're hearing in this discussion is a complete exhaustion of the systems we have in place. I don't actually think squirrels is a small issue. Mm. I think that can lead to a very big issue. But I don't know all the issues that the inspector is seeing, right? I mean, they could be dealing with so many large, crazy issues that a squirrel living in your home may be a pretty small one to them. But to us, when we're living in the space, those kind of things can be so disruptive and add to a worsening life quality, right? Mm-hmm. So it can be difficult, but also understand that this is not the problem of the inspector. This is the problem of the landlord. But trying to get enforcers and support to take care of it, they've put a really hard strain on our system, and it shows.
Well, one of the tips you provide, I've even put it to work right away. When you do finally get that maintenance technician in your apartment, in your home, get their expertise while you have it. And I really love that advice. What more can you say there?
I think that a lot of times we can just watch them. We can be in their presence. Once we get a couple of words from them, right? If they diagnose the problem, we're able to actually Google. We live in a world where if we have the right word choices and have the right knowledge on and what we're looking at, we can do a lot of the research. But often we don't even have the framework to Google, you know, the plumbing issue or the electrical issue or, you know, all those type of issues that we may have. But if we're able to just get a few keywords, maybe we can look it up in my book or look it up on Google. And that's a great start. I think that never be relaxed on trying to find information that may help you now or maybe 5 or 10 years down the road. You never know when information comes in handy.
And you have the Mercury method. It's, you know, to identify and tackle these difficult issues. Can you walk us through the Mercury method?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm a firm believer that if we can troubleshoot things, mm-hmm. if we can kind of look at problems, it doesn't necessarily matter if we are someone who is never done this repairs or not, because a lot of those things can be solved if we just kind of walk through our steps of figuring it out. One of the very first steps is about isolating the problem, right? We want to identify and then isolate the problem. Once we can kind of figure out how the problem is happening, like let's say for an instance we're dealing with a door not opening properly, right? Well, if we can isolate the problem and we can find out what is the issue, is it the hinge itself, the hinge rusted, is it beyond repair, do we need to replace it, or are we looking at maybe do we need to plane the top of the door, do we need to change the pins and the hinges? If we can isolate what is causing the problem itself, then we can actually implement. Then we can actually start working on the problem. And that's kind of what the Mercury method is. It's just a new way of looking at troubleshooting and kind of giving us various steps to kind of make sure that we can solve the problem itself.
And at the end of the method, you suggest that we breathe. And I'm wondering, you know, kind of taking stock, taking a moment, why are those emotional resets really important?
Studies have shown that when people are in emotional heightened states, that we don't take in or retain as much information. And I think when we are trying to educate ourselves, especially, it can be a really frustrating experience. Because we may mess up or we may not feel like we are adequate in order to do these jobs. Mm-hmm. But if we remind ourselves to breathe, to try to stay as calm as we possibly can, we actually retain and take in more information. And that can help us. And remember, we don't know what we don't know. Beating yourself up about something you did not know previously, to me, is really beneficial to not beneficial to learning and growing and taking care of ourselves.
Mercury Stardust, our guide to home maintenance technician. You can call in with your repair questions, comments, experiences, 800-642-1234. Key in Madison is here. Key, hi. Are you there?
Hi.
Hi, yes.
I'm here.
Go ahead.
Hi. Okay. So I live in an apartment building in Madison, and it's from the 1980s, and I've lived here 3 years, and I'm having recurring mold. And I know that the humidity is an issue, so I put on the heat light that's on the ceiling, and then I put on the Brone, what they call an exhaust fan, which is on the wall. And, well, while the maintenance person was here fixing the Johnny ring in the toilet, I asked him about it, and he said, because the fan is blowing in, like I put a lighter up there once, it just blew the light, it blew the flame out. And he said, oh, well, that's not vented to the outdoors. That doesn't do anything. That's supposed to blow in.
Mm.
And I really felt like I was being gaslighted. And I really appreciate what you just said about not being able to take in and retain information when you have a heightened sense of this. And that's how I feel when the maintenance person comes over.
Yeah, it could be really hard, right? Like when we're talking to maintenance technicians, it could be really difficult because there's a power dynamic that they might not even be aware of. A lot of technicians, you know, we clock in, we clock out, and we're almost detached from what the realities are for the people who are living there. And I think that we don't talk about it enough in our industry about how we're dealing. These are really important jobs. And many of us in the industry are considered, you know, emergency workers in some ways. A lot, like I was an emergency call often, and I would show up people's houses at like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning at very difficult times. And I think we need to have empathy and compassion for those moments. But to help with the molding issue.
Meanwhile, the mold.
Meanwhile, the mold. I think it's really important to talk about dehumidifiers, especially in bathrooms. So you're not alone, Key. In the state of Wisconsin, when it comes to bathrooms having proper exhaust systems, it can be actually kind of an uphill battle. A lot of these places were ushered in before certain codes kind of came in. So they're kind of protected underneath the law. You know, they don't necessarily have to make them as airflowy as they should, right? But dehumidifiers can be a huge asset They're going to make sure that that moisture is being sucked out while it's happening, and that's a good thing, okay? So I always think of dehumidifiers being applied 20 minutes before a shower and then 20 minutes after the shower. And if you do that, you're going to notice a pretty significant drop in mold growth and spreading.
You also write that bleach is not the right product for getting rid of mold. What would you use instead?
Any type of product that has bleach, that has mold killer in it, right? You want to try to kill it as much as you can, and using it 3 to 5 times a week is good. Vinegar is another one. If we're looking for a low-cost solution, vinegar is actually a lot better than bleach. Bleach, can it kill the mold? Yeah, but it's hard to actually get to the source of it. You have to go through drywall and paint and plaster and then go to the back of it, and that can be really difficult. You're not really solving the problem. What we want is to try to keep the spread of it down as renters and try to make sure that it's not going to get into the air. So getting vinegar can actually neutralize the components of the bacteria and the mold and can actually help us from keeping it out in the air and stuff. So do that and then use a dehumidifier on top of that. And within 3 to 4 weeks, you'll start seeing results.
Ooh, and that distilled white vinegar, I'm loving it on shower doors to get rid of all of the that sediment that builds up. It is fabulous.
Yeah, the white vinegar is a savior. We honestly, like when it comes to repairs, I always kept a little bit of a bottle with me in my bag all the time because you could use it for so much different stuff.
Well, let's bring in Nancy now in Milwaukee. Nancy, what's going on?
I live in a duplex. I have lived here for 47 years, and both the upper and lower apartment doors were put on wrong. They open outward instead of inward. This is actually a very unsafe situation because anybody trying to get and successfully getting in from the outside could just easily take these doors off their hinges and get into the apartments. So I am lately deciding to call in a handyman to take the doors down and reposition them so that they open the correct way, which is what should have been done to begin with. So my question is, can an average handyman do that, or should I call a carpenter who has gone through a carpenter's apprenticeship program?
Such a good question, Nancy. I will say right out of the gate that it all depends on how everything is structured. I would say that we could do that stuff pretty easily as maintenance technicians. Most of the time, it was a couple hours job, but we could do the job. As far as is it possible in this situation, without me looking at it, I couldn't tell you definitively if it is going to be one that we could do without having a carpenter intervention. But it can be something that can be done if it's the right kind of frame. If it's an exterior door, chances are it will be a much more difficult route, and you may need a carpenter to kind of help this project along and get some people who do door hanging professionally every day rather than just a technician who does it once in a while.
Mercury Stardust, professional home maintenance technician in Wisconsin, fielding your questions on home repair projects and things you want to fix to make your space more livable. Call in to find out if Mercury can troubleshoot at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Wisconsin-based professional maintenance technician Mercury Stardust as our guide to home projects and repairs. New guidebook is called Safe and Sound, and it includes step-by-step instructions on how to fix dozens of home maintenance issues. You can call in with yours, questions, and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Okay, Mercury, we're going to turn our attention to garbage disposals that you call not magical go-away machines. Where does the food go in the disposal?
Once it goes down into the disposal, it gets eat up by a dinosaur. No, it gets all chumped up real small and tiny, and then it goes down into our sewage waste system. And that's actually a really good segue to how we should remember that just putting anything down in a garbage disposal isn't a great idea. And that remember that all because you can put it down there doesn't mean you should. And that we should be mindful of our local communities and try to make sure we prevent of a larger sewage issue. Our infrastructure system in the country is getting quite old. And as we have read probably many articles across the country for the last several years, a lot of these infrastructures are not able to handle the high income of sewage or traffic. And it's important that we're doing our part to make sure that we're not adding to a larger issue that may be developing, especially when it comes to those darn flushable wipes. Oh, because it says flushable wipes does not mean you should flush the wipes.
So when you talk about our infrastructure across the country, it reminds me that you've just seen the country. You were on this 54-city book tour. What was one of your favorite moments or interactions on the tour?
Meeting trans kids across the country was something that is so special that I can't put into words. As as someone who is considered an elder in the trans community, which makes me just shake my head for so many reasons. But as someone who is a role model for kids now within my own trans community, it has been a beautiful thing to watch. Seeing trans kids see an adult who is successful and a number one New York Times best-selling author is so rare. 0.01 authors will achieve something like that. And I'm so lucky and privileged to be in that position to be able to show kids that we can be who we are and also do the things we want to do. I met an amazing kid in Columbia, Ohio, who wanted to be like an astrophysicist, and they were only 11 years old, and they knew more about science than I think I have ever heard in my entire life. And these are amazing, extraordinary kids with amazing, extraordinary parents who are willing to do anything for them. And I think that seeing this many people across the country with that many cities was just a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and I'm so thankful I got to go on it.
Have you been changed by that, by these experiences?
Yeah. I think that for a long time online, I felt like this was a burden. I don't really necessarily like being in the public eye. But when I see the good that we're able to do by having the discussions like we're having today, and I see the good that we're doing by raising, you know, like $2 million for gender-affirming care like we did last year by using my platform, we're helping and changing lives long beyond my lifetime. We're going to be helping people for a long time because of the words that I'm sharing, the inspiration that we're giving, and the hope that we're instilling into our youth. And I get to see that right in front of me now when I traveled around the country. And I don't think you can be the same person when you come back from something like that. You have to be mindful of how impactful you are. And that means we're kind of playing the long game and making sure that I'm going to be here doing the things I'm doing for the next 30 years.
And meanwhile, also, you know, trying to figure out all the tools in the toolbox. I mean, you know, being a maintenance technician,
yeah,
things are always changing. You're always feeling like you're just trying to keep up. Is that challenging?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of. I mean, you know, I always talk about the duality of what my job is, right? My job is part activism and about advocacy for renters and also my own trans community, right? Mm-hmm. And another part of it is making sure that I know what miter saws are on the market. that dichotomy is so funny, you know? Like, I'll be sitting here one day making a table saw, miter saw combination table. And the next day I am, you know, talking with, you know, a lawyer about advocacy for, you know, a small community. And it's really interesting, kind of where I find myself and trying to remember that I can't be everything for everybody, but I can be everything for individuals. And that's what I'm trying to do, is I'm trying to help as many people as I can individually.
Well,
and
here,
I think that goes in solving larger problems.
Well, here comes Adam and Nina with a quick question. Oh. Adam, hi.
Hello.
What would you like to ask?
Well, I had a question. Kind of a longer story, but I'll try to keep it short. Basically, New Year's Eve morning, early hours, our carbon monoxide detector, we currently rent a single-family home. And at early morning on New Year's Eve, our carbon monoxide detectors went out. Everyone got out safe. Fire department came. And they said that what happened was that the previous night we have a wood-burning fireplace in our living room. And we had a fire the previous day, and I let it smolder like normal overnight to go out. And they said when the heat kicked on in the morning, that the cold air returns basically reversed the flow of the chimney and sucked into the house. So they said to vent out the house, everyone, and that was what was causing it. It wasn't the furnace or anything.
Okay.
Like that.
And Adam, I'm so sorry to cut you short here. A carbon monoxide detectors, mercury, any advice there?
I'm making sure that we have them in the right locations is actually kind of a lifesaver too. You know, what Adam was just talking about is a really good reasoning why we should have multiple throughout the home, especially when we're dealing with ones that have chimneys.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's a really good, important contribution of the conversation itself. Make sure we have them and make sure we're checking them. They all have testers. We should be testing them a couple times a year, too minimal, I would say. Same thing with fire alarms, too. And we should understand that smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors are not the same thing, and we should be mindful of that as well.
Mercury, such a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you.
Oh, Mercury Stardust, author of Safe and Sound, A Renter-Friendly Guide to Home Repair. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.